This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, this is The Money. I'm Richard Ailey. And today we're looking at high-speed rail, also known as the very fast train.
People have been trying to get a very fast train up in this country for nearly 50 years.
You know, that's all the more reason to keep going.
It hasn't got up. What does that tell you?
We lack vision.
Or else it simply won't work.
Have you ever looked into it?
No, not personally.
Then I don't understand how you can be so negative. Don't take away their dream.
Okay, we don't have high-speed rail. Not yet. Maybe not ever. But other countries do. How many are we talking about? John Preston has been keeping score. He's Professor of Rail Transport at the University of Southampton.
As of the beginning of this year, I think there's around 18 countries who have high-speed rail and a further 26 who have aspirations for high-speed rail. There's around 46,000 kilometres of line in the world. China has the vast majority, 31,000. Then next come Japan, Spain and France, each with networks of broadly 3,000 kilometres. And then the rest are spread around in small bits across a number of countries.
Why would Australia join that club? Actually, better question, what would make it worthwhile? Marion Terrell is the director of the Transport and Cities Programme at the Grattan Institute.
There's sort of two things going on here. One is that this is a project that is not going to stand on its own two feet commercially. So it needs government subsidy. And in fact, it needs a huge amount of government subsidy, eye-watering amount, of the order of $120 billion. And so just to put that in perspective, that's $5,000 for every person in Australia. It's a generation's worth of infrastructure funding. And a lot of where the patronage for this is going to come from is taking it out of the airlines. So what we're doing, for the most part, is getting people to stop flying and start taking high-speed rail. In other words, something that stands on its own two feet commercially at the moment in aviation, we want to replace it with something with this enormous taxpayer subsidy.
What Marion Terrell's talking about is a huge project that would link Brisbane to Melbourne via Sydney. This has come up several times. The last feasibility study was during the Gillard government. John Preston says there's a range of reasons that countries decide to go ahead with high-speed rail.
So there's one, just being able to get from A to B more quickly. And so clearly it's about speed, but it's also about capacity. If you take your very fastest trains off your classic rail and run them on dedicated or primarily dedicated tracks, you then can release quite a lot of capacity on the existing classic rail for slower or medium fast services. There may also be advantages of separating the faster and the slower trains in terms of reliability of service. And of course, if you're making rail more attractive, then you can take passengers off the roads that may be congested, off air, which may be seen to be less environmentally friendly than rail. So I think there are some good transport factors why you might invest in high-speed rail. But then there may be other economic factors, such as the promotion of rail manufacturing. So the Japanese, the French, the Koreans, for example, champion their domestic producers. There's a nation-building political integration, which I think I've referred to. There may be wider economic benefits from high-speed rail, bringing commercial centres closer together so they trade more, perhaps helping development out of on the edge of the city centre rather than in the city centre. And there may be pure old-fashioned Keynesian microeconomic pump priming reasons for investing in rail infrastructure at certain times in an economic cycle.
And just as there are different objectives, there are different approaches to getting on with it. In Australia, we've had lots of reports, lots of them. And it's the same in Britain and the US.
Sometimes in the literature, that's been referred to as paralysis by analysis. It tends to be in jurisdictions that have fairly convoluted planning, funding and political systems. By contrast, there are countries in the world, China, of course, being the most notable one, which have gone for a big bang and built their networks relatively quickly. partly in a drive for modernity and nation building. But China's not alone. Spain's built its network relatively quickly as well, but albeit nowhere on the same scale as the Chinese. Then somewhere in between, you've had the more step-by-step gradual approach of the Japanese building up their network from 1964 onwards, and the French from around 1981 onwards.
To understand where we are now in Australia, we need to go back in time. Peter Thornton runs Transportation Associates. He's been around this idea for decades.
I think it started with firstly with the Institution of Engineers, who made a proposition to improve Australia's rail systems, and particularly on the East Coast. But that was followed up really by a proposal that came out of CSIRO that was led by the head of CSIRO, Dr. Paul Wild. And Paul came back to Australia after having travelled on trains in Japan and felt that the journey time to Canberra by train, where he was based, was too slow, and that couldn't they do something about that. And he and some of his colleagues in CSIRO put together a proposal, which morphed its eventually into what was called the Very Fast Train. And eventually that was not just CSIRO, but there are a number of other commercial corporate backers as well.
Where are we at this point?
About 1985.
Right. What happened after that?
That proposal was received by government and it was considered. But government found that they were really asking for concessions in terms of the ability to own land in the corridor. And that they, I think the view was, is that they really could not make it work commercially as a transport system, that it required tax breaks and a whole lot of other concessions that government wasn't prepared to give.
That might have been the end of it, but it wasn't.
The next thing probably to say is that state governments, particularly in New South Wales, started to look at these corridors, and they started to do some work to look at how these things could be improved. And it got reborn in the form of the Speed Rail Consortium, and that was led by some people who'd been involved with Very Fast Train Project and who said, look, if we can cut this down, maybe we can make it work over the shorter corridor of Sydney to Canberra. They did a lot of work at their own expense to try and develop a proposal. But at the same time, there were some other people as well who said, look, perhaps the way they're conceiving high-speed rail isn't the way to go, that we should look at the Swedish model, where they introduced tilting trains, and as did the Italians, because they decided that they needed to squeeze as much as they could out of the existing infrastructure.
Right. So what you tell
we're,
me where
we're around 1992-3, somewhere about there.
Right. Okay. What happens with those ideas?
The private sector starts banging on the door of government saying, you know, please let us have a go at this. We can make this work. The consortium that I ultimately became involved with, led by the Swedish conglomerate ABB, actually brought rolling stock out to Australia. They ran trials. They could demonstrate that they could save time on the journey down to Mittagong. I think they actually ran it for a while to Canberra as well. They showed that it could work.
By the mid-90s, the federal government says, OK, show us what you've got.
The government called a competition for Sydney-Canberra. This was the Commonwealth government. And in the end, there were four proposals that were offered to government. One by the Speed Rail Consortium. That was based on using French technology because they had the French rolling stock manufacturer Alstom as a part of their team. Mm-hmm. And that required substantially rebuilding the alignment because they wanted to run trains at 300 kilometre an hour sorts of speeds. Another proposal came from people that I ended up doing some work with, the ABB AdTrans Consortium, who proposed travel time around 2 hours using tilting train technology, but not having to build nearly so much infrastructure. And another proposal also came from the German company Siemens, a similar proposal to the ABB AdTrans proposal. And there was a fourth, and this was the wild card in that a proposal based on the German Transrapid technology, which is a magnetic levitation system, was also put forward.
All right. So that gets more or less to about the turn of the century.
That sort of gets you up to about there, yes. And but the outcome of that process was that the government selected the Speedrail Consortium to go forward to the proving up stage. But in the proving up stage, they were unable to satisfy government that they could build the project at no net cost.
So it dies and it's dead and it's finally gone.
This never dies. This is like Rip Van Winkle. It goes to sleep for a while and then it wakes up. But in killing the Sydney-Canberra project, the Commonwealth said, look, to date, this has always been pushed out government. This has been the private sector saying, you know, have we got a deal for you? We can do this. Let us have a go. Government, let everybody have a go in the Sydney-Canberra high-speed rail competition. But in shutting it down, the government said, look, it's time we looked at it for ourselves. We need to look at this from the perspective of government. And they then called tenders for a study to look at the issue of high-speed rail on the east coast of Australia.
Peter Thornton says this was important because it made it clear that only the government could fund the infrastructure. And even if it was built, running the service might not be a going concern.
We always had people who were more than willing to design it, more than willing to study it, more than willing to sell us rolling stock, more than willing to put some earth-moving equipment out there to move earth or lay track. Very, very few organisations prepared to take the risk that this would be a successful transport business.
Right. So people willing to, I guess, finance, people willing to design and build, nobody putting their hand up to say, do you know, we want to run this for you.
That's right.
It's quite a telling thing, isn't it?
It's a very telling thing. I mean, certainly there would be people who would be prepared to run it, but the issue is whether or not they would be prepared to take the commercial risk without ever having to put their hand out to government and say, you know, well, this needs financial support.
So where are we at?
Nowhere. Same place we've been for 50 years.
Oh, I don't understand why you're being so negative. I've been doing this job 20 years, and trust me, every time we announce a very fast train, 95% of Australians are for it.
And the other 5%?
Who are they?
Engineers, economists, experts in transport logistics.
Yeah, the lunatic fringe. Real people love it. So where are we at?
Well, we're trying to secure the rail corridor between Sydney, Brisbane and Melbourne, because if you want to build this
I don't want to build it. I want to launch it. I'm thinking an ambassador, someone to be the face of it. Who's that person that really loves trains?
I don't know.
Oh, you see them on TV all the time.
The fat controller.
Tim Fisher.
Does he like trains? You know what, I think we need to keep a lid on this, Rhonda.
No, we need to build a buzz, generate excitement.
This is The Money on RN, the ABC Listen app, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Richard Adie. Today we're looking at high-speed rail, and you've just been hearing a bit about how we got to where we are now, which is not to have any of it at all. But Rico Murcutt, who's Professor of Transport at the University of Sydney Business School, says that might be changing.
So after we had various studies, you know, in the past, you know, in the 80s, 90s, all looking at connecting Brisbane with Sydney, then via Canberra with Melbourne, which have all gone nowhere, we have now a situation where three state governments, so Queensland, Victoria and New South Wales, look into their own high-speed, or should we say faster rail projects.
Higher speed.
Higher speed, that's correct. So it might not be 300 kilometers per hour, as we see, say, in Europe or in Japan, other parts of the world, but it might be something between 130 and 200, perhaps a little bit more than 200 kilometers per hour.
This comes after the federal government made $20 million available for business cases for high-speed rail. Part of that money was secured by Transport for New South Wales.
Since Transport for New South Wales has put out that proposal, which was to connect Sydney with Newcastle and cut the journey times, I think from currently 3 hours to 2 hours, which is not really super fast, but it's sort of quite an improvement. The government here in New South Wales has decided to put its own proposal out there. And so they are now talking about four routes, potentially connecting Sydney with Canberra, Sydney, Newcastle. Then the other route is Sydney to Bathurst, potentially Orange and Parkes, and then Sydney, Wollongong to Toonara. And again, what we're talking here is more faster rails than the full high-speed rail thing.
What's Victoria looking at?
Victoria has put, I think, $19 billion aside for connecting Melbourne with places like Ballarat. So they want to cut the travel time to Ballarat to 45 minutes, Geelong 30 minutes, Shepparton just under 2 hours. So quite an improvement in terms of travel time. And as in New South Wales and also as in Queensland, the magic number seems to be 45 minutes. So what all these regions try to do is to connect their cities with the regions and make high-speed rail or faster or rail, more general, more attractive to commuters.
What are the options in Queensland?
So in Queensland, I think they link this to the 2032 Olympic Games that they try to win. And they want to make Brisbane or that region what they call a 45-minute region. So they want to connect the Gold Coast, the South Coast, and also to Toowoomba with Brisbane. And, you know, from all these places, you will be able to travel to Brisbane CBD in 45 minutes, which is really quite attractive.
All of this is less ambitious, more doable than Brisbane-Sydney-Melbourne. It's not purely about speed. Marion Terrell.
A lot of the motivation for this, I think, is the idea that it will help to make regional communities more viable. And this is very consistent with a push that we're seeing from Commonwealth ministers in recent months, where they've worried about population growth in the big cities and they want to distribute and disperse the population over some of the places that don't have many people in them. And I think the thinking is that this type of project would help. So that's all fine. I think it would probably help in the sense that it would help people get from regional towns to work in the city, and in a sense turning them into dormitory towns of the big cities. But there's another way that this is talked about, and that is that it will regenerate the regional economies. And this is a much more doubtful proposition. It certainly doesn't follow automatically that this would happen. And I think people have found overseas that what really happens is that the bigger regional centres, if they get a station, may well sort of cannibalise, if you like, from the smaller towns. So they may benefit. The towns that have got a station may benefit. But most of the benefits, 90% of the benefits in this proposal, don't go to towns and they don't go to the environment. They go to individual travellers and in the form of travel time savings.
So, Rico, in broad terms, what are we looking at? What will these projects cost?
In Queensland, they're talking about $70 billion, and that's probably the most expensive one of the three. Victoria is talking about $19 billion, roughly. And if you look at New South Wales, the latest figures that we have sort of estimated are for the Sydney-Newcastle route. I think you can do that for around $18 billion, and Sydney-Canberra, depending on the speed of the train and whether it's dedicated tracks, it's something around $24 billion. Those are the numbers. Obviously, they can go up, and usually they go up a little bit, particularly when once you involve tunneling, things become fairly expensive, then you have delays, all these sort of things. But those are the sort of ballpark figures.
Those figures will inevitably go up. But which project's closest to starting?
Probably Victoria. But at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter, you know, with these sort of project horizons, whether it's, you know, 40 and 15 years. As long as something happens, I think that's going to be a good message. And once we have the three projects implemented, each on its own, you have the potential, if they ensure that there is interoperability around these three, that you at some point in the future connect these three systems and then have what was initially proposed, that connection from Brisbane, Sydney, Canberra, down to Melbourne, and that would be obviously ideal.
It does beg a lot of questions, doesn't it, about interoperability? We have a history in Australia of train gauges that don't connect with other train gauges.
So it's the gauges, that's one thing. But the other thing with high-speed rail or fast rail is that you also have to pay attention to electrification and also to signalling. So you have to ensure that those signalling systems talk to each other and make sure that interoperability is sort of ensured.
Take the last train to Clarksville and I'll meet you at the station. You can be here by 4:30 because I've made your reservation. Don't be slow. No.
On the money today, we're looking at high-speed rail. A lot of the cost is in the infrastructure. It may require new tracks, new bridges, new tunnels. And that's not all. John Preston.
There's further decisions about where you locate your stations. Do you go all the way into the city centre or do you have your stations on the edge of the city? So the Chinese and Taiwanese and the Koreans to some extent have tended to go for more edge of town stations. You may have some on the edge of the city centre, which may help redevelop new parts of the central city, or you go all the way into the city centre. And then on the lines, there's the decision of how many intermediate stops to have. Obviously, the more intermediate stops you have, the more potential traffic you may have. But it can take high-speed train up to 15 kilometres to get up to full cruising speed, 300 kilometres an hour. So you don't want too many stops because you've got a big time penalty for the end-to-end journey time of all this acceleration and deceleration.
It adds up, and that's before any cost overruns. Unfortunately, they seem to be up there with death and taxes. Marion Terrell.
Looking at all the transport infrastructure projects valued at $20 million or more and built between 2000 and 2015, what you see is that for all these projects, the average cost overrun was about 25%. But when we start to talk about these very big projects, they are more risky. For every 10% increase in project size, the risk of an overrun goes up by 6%. So big projects not only are more likely to have a cost overrun, it's also likely that that cost overrun will be bigger. So Australia's never seen a project as big as this high-speed rail proposal. But if you think about some of the biggest projects that we have seen, they have been I think things like WestConnex is one of the biggest we've had, and the latest numbers that you're seeing in the press are $45 billion. It started out as a $10 billion project. In Melbourne, we've got the Suburban Rail Loop that was an election promise of the government, of the Labor Party that has formed government. And again, $50 billion is the biggest project that we've ever really encountered in transport infrastructure. So when we start talking about something that is more than twice as big, the risk of that is very high.
To avoid the worst of this, John Preston proposes a four-stage test, starting with, does the proposal make a commercial return, and progressing, if that's the word, to does it offer social returns when qualitative wider benefits are taken into account? Marion Terrell frames it a bit differently.
The best practice approach is always to say, what is the problem that we're trying to solve? So is it regional connection? Is it trying to create dormitory suburbs or towns near capital cities? Or is it trying to spark industry in the regions? Is it trying to be a more energy efficient form of transport? Is it national pride? Because whatever your answer to these questions is, will lead you to different kinds of solutions. At the moment, this is a solution looking for a problem.
And then going through having a proper evaluation, proper business case, and that all has to go to Parliament.
I think it should go to Parliament, and I think it should be made public. These projects are popular because no one feels the cost of it. It feels like it's other people's money. And it feels like that, I think, to politicians. And it feels like that to us too. Like you think, how great would that be? Perhaps I'll even take that train one day. But the reality is that there is an opportunity cost here, and we're not counting that. If we have got $120 billion to spare, we could equally ask the question, how would we like to spend that $120 billion? And we can all dream up great ways to do that.
In making an assessment, passenger numbers are really important, but so too is economic geography.
Your ideal situation is to have two big cities that interact with each other quite a lot, but are separated by a fairly considerable distance, typically about 500 kilometres. So with high-speed rail, you can reasonably expect to get that journey time to between those two cities to well below 2 hours. That makes day return business travel feasible. And that's when you start really getting into the market where high speed rail can perform very well.
That's not Australia. Our big cities are too far apart. And that seems to be recognised. Queensland, Victoria and New South Wales are moving toward higher speed rail that might get joined up in 40 years or so. But which bit has the strongest case? Peter Thornton.
I think you can't ignore Sydney-Newcastle. In fact, I believe you really have to focus on Sydney-Newcastle. And the reason I say that is that it is now the most heavily used corridor in the whole of Australia, not only for passenger but also for freight. Most of the railway, fast railways that were developed originally, if you look at the classic Tokaido line in Japan, or if you look at Paris-Lyon with the TGV, the first lines, they were developed because they ran out of capacity on the existing classic lines. And so they said, if we're going to build a new railway, we're going to build it to a different standard. We're going to look for different operating performances. Sydney-Newcastle has been around since the 1880s. It has been rebuilt a couple of times to try and improve it, but nothing substantially. If we're going to make changes in that corridor, if we're going to change the service paradigm, if we're going to give people a better travel time, then certainly we need to look at that. But that involves very big cost, because getting across the Hawkesbury, which is a fjord, is very difficult in railway terms.
Steepest grade in the state, just this side of the river, I think.
So it's a 1 in 40 ruling grade.
Rico Murcutt agrees about the importance of Sydney-Newcastle, but he's more optimistic about what can be achieved with the same alignment. Actually, he's pretty optimistic, full stop.
Yes, I was very critical previously, and we have been involved in lots of these studies in the past. And when they looked at, you know, the full thing, you know, at the eastern seaboard connecting Brisbane, Sydney, Canberra, and Melbourne, that was just too much, right? That was just too large of a project, particularly when you hear these numbers, you know, like there was talk that this project would involve 144 kilometers worth of tunneling. 114 billion was the sort of conservative estimate in terms of the capital cost. And so all of this was indicating, look, this is probably never going to happen. But now that we have three independent proposals, I think each of them has merit. And I think we will see at least a lot of upgrades to existing infrastructure, which makes a lot of sense in my view.
What about you, Marion? Are you a skeptic about all of this?
I think the spending of public money is a serious responsibility and shouldn't be done recklessly. So I would be very happy for governments to do their due diligence, find the answer, and then come to the public and say either the case does stack up and we'd like to go ahead, or say it doesn't, but we'd like to go ahead anyway for these reasons. And so that it's a transparent and open process instead of kind of essentially pretending that nobody has to pay.
That would require governments to treat us like grown-ups, of course.
Yeah.
That's probably where we should leave it.
I can afford to board a Chattanooga choo-choo. I've got my fare and just a trifle to spare.
Marion Terrell directs the Transport and Cities program at the Grattan Institute. You also heard from Rico Murcutt, Professor of Transport and Supply Chain Management at the University of Sydney Business School, Peter Thornton, Principal of Transportation Associates, and John Preston, Professor of Rail Transport at the University of Southampton. The Money is produced by Belinda Summer. Our sound engineer is Jennifer Parsonage. I'm Richard Ady.
Chattanooga, there you are. There's gonna be a certain party at the station in satin and lace. I used to call funny face. She's gonna cry until I tell her that I'll never run. So Chattanooga, choo-choo, won't you choo-choo me home?
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.